You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. It is 8:07, and Captain Matt Foreman's going to join us right now, and I just found out that I probably used the wrong pitcher for Matt. So, Matt, I promoted you major and threw a picture of you out there, but probably the wrong guy. So, with apologies, good morning. How are you doing?
Good morning. I'll take the extra money if you have it.
I was going to say, you're probably like most. Hey, I don't need the name. I need the money. So unless you're coming with the money, do whatever the hell you want. All right, Matt, we're going to talk about an article that you wrote in the Gazette called Defining the War on ISIL. So, but before we do that, we got to find out about you. So so let's find out about you. First of all, born and raised where?
Yeah, I was born in born in Denver, Colorado, raised in Newhall, California, just north of L.A.
Newhall, California. Yeah, that used to be a really small place, but it gets bigger by the year, yes?
Yeah, Magic Mountain certainly helps with that. There's also a lot of Hollywood stuff going on there.
Yeah, yeah, a lot of pressure just from L.A. headed north. It's got nowhere else to go, man. Born and raised in Newhall, where'd you go to school?
Went to the Naval Academy. For college.
Oh, so now we got to, now you got to take responsibility for that. So this will be interesting. So how did the Naval Academy get on your radar as a kid? It's not very typical. So how did it get on your radar?
So I became interested in the military around junior high, high school. Originally wanted to go to the Air Force Academy to fly airplanes. My eyesight was terrible, so I thought that flying wasn't going to be an option. Explored West Point. When I found out that I could get laser eye surgery, which I ended up having, went back to the Naval Academy because it gives the best options out of school. You could go, you know, anything from Marine ground to be a surface warfare officer in the Navy to be a pilot. So kind of figured I'd try for there and see what my options were after that. Ended up going and becoming a pilot.
So you said you're in junior high school. And the Marine, you still there?
I am.
Okay. And the military gets on your horizon. How, were you just one of those little goofballs rolling around playing army all the time and stuff like that? Was it stuff on TV? How did it get on your radar?
So, partly through my interest in, a little bit through national politics. Mainly because, you know, I saw the need for defending this country, and that's something that became interesting to me. It was one of the history classes I took where we discussed politics a lot in that class. So kind of developed an interest in the military due to that. Then the year later is when 9/11 happened. So this is the case for pretty much everybody in my generation who joined. I think 9/11 was at least a little bit of a factor in that.
Right.
So that kind of catalyzed me, and then, you know, kind of the standard stuff for pilots, you know, watching Top Gun growing up, gave me a little bit of an interest in flying.
You're gonna admit to that in public?
Yeah, maybe a little. Probably getting in a little bit of trouble for that.
Exactly. There's a samurai code that surrounds that movie, because the truth is they're all geeks about it, but they're not supposed to talk about it in public. They could literally recite the dialogue from that thing, right?
Absolutely.
And we wouldn't know it, but you'll be with an air, you know, like with an air officer, and all of a sudden his head snaps. Like, what just happened? Like, hey, man, that was dialogue from Top Gun. You don't know that? Like, sorry, man, I don't have all of it memorized like we do, but we don't talk about it. So, you will have to pay for that. No doubt. All right, so all that gets you there, but there's nobody in your history, though, that's, you know, uncle, grandfather, that's pointing you towards the Marine Corps. It's just service in general.
Not the Marine Corps necessarily. I'm actually half British, half American. My father grew up in the UK. His father was a pilot in the Royal Air Force, and then my mom's dad, who was American, was a B-24 pilot in World War II. He was shot down over Romania, POW, in one of the German POW camps for a year. So both my grandfathers were pilots. My dad had an interest in aviation, but he took the civilian route, worked for the Ministry of Defense for a little while. But no direct family necessarily, or no immediate family anyways.
Okay. What about, all right, so you go to the Naval Academy, and how does this, now you're currently a Harrier pilot, yes?
Correct.
Okay. So how do you get down that road? One, you get your eyes done, and everything works out there, so you become eligible, and then why the Marine Corps, and then why Harriers?
So, obviously, as you mentioned, you broke it down into two questions. One of the big things with the Marine Corps, it's in no means a disparagement of my Navy friends. But
go ahead. Hey, go ahead, man. This is All Marine Radio, man. We rip them a new ass all the time.
No, right. Going there, you kind of see a difference in the Navy and the Marine Corps, and it's certainly not trying to be overly generalistic, but by and large, the Marines tend to be more type A, more interested in PT, harder workers. So that kind of attracted me to the Marine Corps. Plus, I like the focus that we have in Marine aviation, particularly that we're very grunt centric. We know what the end state is. We know what the mission is. It's to ensure success on the ground. So I like that. I like the idea of TBS. And then as far as Harrier pilot goes, going through flight school, most guys end up wanting to be Hornet pilots. About halfway through my time there, kind of recycled on myself, looked at the situation, figured out one, I would rather be an air to ground pilot that can also do air to air than an air to air pilot that can also do air to ground. So that kind of drew me to the Harrier.
Whoa. All right.
It's nothing with the Marine Hornets. They're, certainly phenomenal people. I have plenty of friends in those communities, and they're,
Matt, stop trying to say you're not disparaging people after you've just done it twice, okay? Okay, relative to the Navy, the Marine Corps Department of the Navy, Matt, which department are we?
The men's department.
Thank you very much. All right. And the Hornet guys, they're air-to-air guys who do ground, and the Harriers are air-to-ground guys who do air. So it is what it is. You don't need to apologize for it. It's All Marine Radio, man. We know the deal. So, all right. So F-18 pilots are losers, and so you saw the light and went to Harriers. Now, let me tell you, I don't like the Harrier because it's such a pig relative to gas. It checks on with like 6 minutes of station time. And you're like, what do we do with this thing? And we better figure it out in a hurry because this thing has got to go get refueled and then it's got to go home. Talk to me about that. Why is it, was it us? Because in Afghanistan, they would check on with like 12 minutes of fuel. What's the problem with that aircraft?
So I don't think that's necessarily the case, especially with external tanks.
Okay.
I just got done with a deployment without getting into, too many details on that. We would generally provide the same vol length as the Hornets that we relieved over there. So we'll provide, depending on the scenario, it depends on, where our tanker is, how much ordnance we're carrying, stuff like that. But we'll generally provide 45 minutes to an hour on station, which is commensurate with what Hornets were doing.
Okay. All right, so probably based on the configuration relative to ordnance and some other things, may have cut down their station time. Okay, so you're telling me I shouldn't be a hater.
Yeah.
All right.
The Harrier is it's a great airplane. It's very good at the air to ground mission, and it's certainly the mission that we train for the most in the community.
Okay. All right. So when do you you become a Harrier pilot? When do you get to the operating forces? What year?
I checked in the beginning of 2014, so almost 5 years after I commissioned.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. It's an extensive training pipeline.
Yeah, no kidding. Okay, so now you're working for a living. At what point do you begin to write? Have you always been a writer? Do you find writing easy? How do you become a writer?
So I've always been interested in that. My mind kind of gravitated towards, again, the poli-sci major we talked about a little bit earlier.
Right.
So at the academy, I was both a poli-sci major and a physics major, because I also enjoy math. But as far as the poli-sci major goes, I did the honors track there, which pretty much focuses your studies after the first few classes on writing an extensive honors thesis on a very specific subject. And so I ended up writing about a 130-page dissertation there on terrorist recruitment. So that kind of, my studies there got me interested in, you know, asymmetric warfare, counterinsurgency, counterterrorism. So that was kind of the genesis of both writing and my interest in writing this article.
Okay, we're going to hit pause on your article here for a second. Since you're a poli-sci guy, you want to talk about national politics right now?
Probably wouldn't. Depends on the question.
Okay, all right. And since you're being Captain Matt Foreman right now, I won't put you in a situation that... give me your thoughts. The country pretty polarized right now.
Right.
Give me your thoughts on... Do you have a thought on why... it's almost like we have two pieces of the nation that look at it through such different prisms. They see such different things, and the level of hostility is like I've never seen it in my lifetime. Certainly, I'm curious about your thoughts about where we are politically as a nation.
There are obviously several factors, but I think two of the big ones that contribute to that. One is the way we receive our news these days. And again, I realize I'm speaking on a talk radio station right now. But I think people tend to, with the explosion of the internet, with the explosion of talk radio, and with, you know, kind of how print journalism and the mainstream media has always been, people tend to gravitate towards news sources that confirm their point of view.
Right.
So, it's a lot easier nowadays to think that extremist ideas are mainstream because we can get into our little echo chambers on the internet and hear exactly what we want to hear. So I think you've seen a hardening of political views with that. And I think one of the other major things that contributes and I think the way we receive news now is a factor in this. But I think we tend to kind of be extremists. You know, everything is, you know, the biggest thing that's ever happened. You know, if you're a guy on the right, you know, President Obama is and I'm obviously not saying this, but, you know, people on the right would tend to say President Obama is the worst president we've ever had.
Right.
Or if you're on the left, President Trump is the worst president we've ever had. You tend to see people who think, you know, their outlook on history is so short. You look at the history of our country, and I don't care what side you're on, we've seen worse situations than what we're seeing right now. You think the situation in Congress is bad now? You know, pre-Civil War, a senator was beaten on the floor with a cane. You know, that isn't happening anymore, but, we tend to think that
maybe it should. Hey, maybe it should, though. Maybe they could use a little bit of – they're getting their ass whooped a little bit. Let me just – that was tough love. What is it, Calhoun? Who beat who?
I don't remember. I think it was I don't remember.
I'll have to look it up.
It was certainly in relation to the Civil War. It was a pro-abolitionist senator.
Right. My guest, Matt Foreman, Captain Type, Harrier Pilot, and we're going to get to his article here in a few minutes entitled Defining the War on ISIL, but we're talking a little bit of politics. Just to make you a fan of Al-Marin Radio, I will tell you this, Matt. I think you're absolutely right about the news stuff. I think what's been lost in our country, and I would attribute much of it to both talk radio and the way the news we watch, is what gets the most attention. Anything that's inflamed tremendously, right? So you get this overheated debate, What's gone is articulate discourse and articulate dissent. You know, people that will sit and talk and will lay out arguments, will footnote their arguments, and then we'll take on somebody else's argument in an articulate way, not in an overheated way. And I think we're losing that as a nation. And as a result, you know, I don't think we're solving problems. We're just screaming at each other. And I will tell you that when you have smart people on, when you ask them hard questions, and when you ask them to footnote them, that is what people enjoy hearing. But it seems like we see less and less of that and more of the echo chamber and more of the screaming. So I don't disagree with you. But that's why All Marine Radio is such a good thing, because we're not afraid of that. I mean, look, we fought for this country. And we're interested in the nation, and we don't care. As long as you're respectful and, you know, and articulate, come on and express yourself and hopefully be great. But I think it's a huge problem. And I don't know how it gets better, because the people that make the most money, that have the biggest audience, are the people that scream the loudest. And so it's, but the rest of us do what we can. And that's why you're on this program today. So Matt Foreman, our guest, talk about your paper, Defining the War on ISIL. Where did the subject come from? And how did you limit it? Because it's a fairly wide, topic.
Right. So the idea for the paper kind of came when I was deployed in support of OIR, obviously the Harrier pilot conducting airstrikes over there. I was seeing a lot of talk that, you know, we need to scale back the air war and we need to make this a counterinsurgency, which I think is an inaccurate characterization of the war we're fighting. Firstly, they call themselves the Islamic State. Insurgents are exactly that. They're trying to overthrow an existing government. They're trying to, I don't want to say work within the system, because they're absolutely not doing that, but they're not trying to establish, you know, their own state. They're not trying to establish, you know, they're not, the wars aren't necessarily fought with, you know, a defined SWAT, or anything like that. So I thought the characterization of the war was inaccurate, partly because of that, and also partly because ISIS doesn't necessarily, although they have changed their tone a little bit from what I've seen, but they don't necessarily act like an insurgent force. One of the quotations I used in the paper was from Mao Zedong, who likened the, obviously speaking about guerrilla war, but he likened the guerrilla to a fish, and the populace is the water. The fish can't survive without water. So generally, a guerrilla force or an insurgent force depends on that local populace to survive. So they tend to act in a way that endears the local populace to them, and ISIS certainly, for the most part, is not trying to do that. They're making the local populace their sex slaves. They're running around cutting people's heads off, public executions, all of that. So they're not necessarily behaving like a counter or behaving like an insurgent force, which in a lot of ways is good for us, because it's very difficult for an outside power to come in and bolster a counterinsurgent government. It's a lot easier for us to fight against someone that alienates the local populace, because right. They don't have that local populace to provide them the support.
Right. Right. Matt, again, before we get too much deeper into your argument, into your article, does writing come easy for you? Was it something, since you've, you know, going to the Naval Academy is not for the faint of heart, you actually tend to have to do work at that university. Does writing come easy for you? Something you have to work at?
I guess there are kind of two things to coming easily, as far as writing goes. I certainly get writer's block when I'm writing, you know, a lot, but, as far as the actual, you know, formulation of ideas, the structure of the sentences, things like that, I had some phenomenal English teachers growing up in Southern California. We had an excellent school system, and I was never an English student. You know, that was not one of the subjects that interests me, but they kind of sparked a little bit of a love for writing in me through a couple of the advanced placement classes I took there. So it's certainly one of those situations where you'd credit teachers. But as far as writing this paper, again, I think there are two different cases. You're either writing about something you love or you're writing about something you're forced to write about. And if you write about something you love, just like if you're talking about something you love, it certainly flows a lot more easily than if you are forced to write about a given subject.
Question for you, Matt. Can you give, in your writing experience, give one writing tip? My writing tip to people, because, you know, when I've been published a few times, and until I learned to be a good outliner, I could never get to where I wanted to be as a writer, because, you know, there's nothing more frustrating as a writer than when you write something, you hand it to somebody, and you know what you think you wrote, you know what you think is a major idea in that paper. You hand it to somebody and say, tell me what you think of this, tell me what the major idea in that is, and they tell you something else, and you're so pissed. And you're just like, you know, and until, so to me, outlining is the roadmap of making your point. I used to try to sit down and compose, and I was doing Stewart's Ride Around McClellan, and I could never get there. And give a writing pointer, if you will.
I think one of the things that's helped me the most with writing is I'm very interested in language, you know, diction, syntax, the structure sentences and all that. And I think, you know, taking a good interest in the English language will certainly help writing, because you know, the words just flow more easily, when you do that. Certainly not to say, I think outlining overall would be a better point to bring out, because you can't, you know, express your ideas if you don't know what your ideas are in the first place.
Right.
But, you know, that's probably a minor tip.
Okay. All right, Matt, we got to take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to get into the heart of your article and talk about defining the war on ISIL. And that is Matt's article. It appeared in the December or January edition of the Gazette.
It's the January edition.
Man, whoever, you look good as a major, though. I want to tell you that, Matt, just so you know. Just so you know. All right. In the January edition of the Gazette, and we're going to take a quick break. We're going to talk about that when we come back. So, Matt, hang with us through the break.
Okay.
And appreciate you doing this morning. Where are you physically located right now?
I'm in my squadron in Cherry Point right now.
Cherry Point. How's the weather at Cherry Point?
Little cool this morning. It was about 30 degrees, but it's beautiful and clear, warming up, high in the mid-60s today, so not a bad day.
Well, not a bad day. So you do your, did you do your part on Valentine's Day?
I suppose so. It's one of those situations where you ask your wife what she wants, and she says nothing, so do with that what you will.
Did you fall for that? Oh, man.
I'm the household cook, so I'll be cooking dinner tonight.
All right. That's the oldest trick in the book. Right? I lured him in with a piece of bread, and then I crushed his little head. Okay, don't fall for that one, Matt. It's a trick. It's always a trick. What are the things you need
to do? It's a trap.
All right, we'll continue. The Marine Corps Gazette Hour here on a Tuesday edition of All Marine Radio, right on the All Warrior Radio Network. More of that coming up next.
MilitaryByOwner.com is an excellent resource for any military family moving to a new area. We found a ton of homes to choose from and purchased a house 8 days later. This was the only site I used. Thanks, Military by Owner.
Are you PCSing? Do you need to find a home near a military base quickly? With over 45,000 listings and 15 years of experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base, MilitaryByOwner.com can help. Military by Owner. Proven and dependable.
I'm good, but I have a story, and I don't know where to start.
I'm good, but I feel alone in a crowd.
When the service member or veteran in your life says,
I'm good.
Are you really listening?
I still have nightmares.
I'm really not so good. Are you ready to listen?
Suicide prevention is everyone's responsibility. Listen to the veteran or service member in your life. If you are in crisis or know someone who is, call the Veterans Crisis Line and Military Crisis Line at 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
Listen up, employers. Veterans can be a great asset to your company or organization. veterans have gained skills in leadership, teamwork, and performance under pressure. Veterans have received the very best training in their fields and are never afraid to tackle a tough situation to accomplish the mission. If you are looking to hire a veteran, the Department of Labor can help you make it happen. You hire a veteran today, you won't be sorry.
More than 2 million Americans have served in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the Department of Veterans Affairs reports that approximately 11 to 20% of those warriors may have experienced symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. As we recognize PTSD Awareness Month, Real Warriors Campaign volunteer Meg Mitchum, a former Army combat medic who served in Iraq, encourages fellow warriors to reach out when they need help.
The hardest step was admitting that I needed help coping with PTSD. Once I did, my command and unit fully supported me, and I was able to get the care I needed. Getting support helped me succeed in the military and now in my civilian career.
If you or a loved one is coping with an invisible wound, resources are available and they work. For more information, visit the Real Warriors campaign at realwarriors.net or call 866-966-1020.
On Veterans Day, the nation honors the men and women who risk their lives to protect our freedom. Social Security does its absolute best to honor veterans and active duty members of the military every day by giving them the respect they deserve. For those who return home with injuries, Social Security is a resource they can turn to. If you know any wounded veterans, please let them know about Social Security's Wounded Warriors website. The Wounded Warriors website answers many commonly asked questions and shares other useful information about disability benefits, including how veterans can receive expedited processing of disability claims. Learn more by visiting www.socialsecurity.gov/woundedwarriors.
For America's wounded warriors, sometimes coming home can be a battle in itself. Every one of them needs our support to meet the challenges they face every day. The USO provides Americans a way to offer that support to our wounded warriors and their families. Join us. Visit USO.org to learn how you can make a difference in their lives by donating today. The USO.
My name is Juan Perez, Jr. I joined the military in 98. I commissioned as an officer. But I always had in mind the idea that I would go into the special operations community, particularly special forces. I was accepted to go into selection, and I attended on September 8th of 2001. As I was making my departure out of the military, there was that uncertainty. What do I do next? How do I repurpose my skills in a way that's not only meaningful to me, but also that provides for my family and provides an increase in our a way of living, a quality of life. The Global South Foundation has resources when it comes to anything from building resumes to how to relate to a CEO in conversation, how to basically, again, repurpose that which I had learned in a career in special operations, dealing at the strategic and operational level. How do I take that and then turn it towards entrepreneurial spirit into business development? And how do I translate that so somebody can see that value? And in doing so, I landed a magnificent and very rewarding career. I'm the VP of operations for an IT company called BuildSourced. What I say to veterans getting out, be bold. Be bold when you go to network. Go out to the GlobalSoft website, look at what events they have lined up, attend those events, you know, and participate. A lot of the events they hold, they're of key importance in this network. Go out there and engage, just like you would engage in a combat zone, you know, when you're networking there. With folks that don't share necessarily your language, your culture, or your background, and yet we still make it happen. How can we not make it happen here?
The Global Soft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines. You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Had to do it.
I know you did.
You know what? And they love it. No matter what they say, it's ridiculous. This hour of All Marine Radio brought to you by our friends at Battle Mug, home of the Battle Mug. Don't you know? Anyway, it starts with a 10.5 pound block of T6 billet aluminum. It's milled, machined, and anodized. And when it's done, you have a quality product ready to be customized. You can, if you're in the office, you can put flags, you can put emblems on it, unit emblems, all kinds of stuff. When you go to the field, It's got Picatinny rails on it, so you can put lasers, binoculars, scopes, cameras. It's got a lid on it so you don't dump your coffee in your lap. And it's heavy duty. Its handle is the handle for an M16. So it's an awesome gift. Why would you get it? Farewells, promotions, retirements, and other special occasions, or Valentine's Day. So you, if you don't have a gift for your significant other, go cut a picture of the battle mug, go print it out, put it in a card, give it to your significant other, ladies, and say, hey, man, I got you this. And then call them up and order. You get it. You can have their name and their unit laser engraved on the base of it. And if you go to battlemug.com right now, type in the promo code Marine, you'll get 15% off. So it's a veteran-owned company. It's a Marine-owned company, and all of it made entirely in the USA and battlemug.com. And it's a home security device because if you take this thing and you smoke somebody in the head with it, you will put them down, no question. So sounds like a good deal. Yeah, Matt?
Yeah.
Awesome, yeah. Anyway, Kenny Loggins. All right, we continue. Matt Foreman, Captain Type, United States Marine Corps, Harrier pilot. I got an email question for you. Hey, Matt. Got a Harrier question for Matt. I've always been fascinated by the platform, and but it looks pretty. It looks pretty nerve wracking to try to control. Is it as scary as it looks when you go from horizontal flight to attempting to go vertical, or has all that been sorted out and it's just simply another phase of being a pilot in that aircraft? So that historically has been a little bit exciting. Is it just another piece of the job now, Matt?
Yes, the Harrier is certainly, I think, probably the most difficult aircraft to fly in the U.S. inventory. Coming out of so kind of the way flight school works, you fly your little propeller airplane out of there is where you select jets, helicopters, Ospreys, C-130s. In order to get jets, you have to basically be in the top 50%. The cut's actually a little bit higher than the top 50%. In order to get jets in the first place, and then in order to get Harriers, you have to be same position out of jet school. So the Harrier is the only jet platform with that extra cut. So, again, as guys go through flight school, normally they want to fly Hornets. Usually the top guy gets Hornets, maybe not if they don't have any spots. The next several highest get Harriers, and then Hornets again for people who didn't make the Harrier cut, and then the Prowlers as well. So the Marine Corps recognizes that in flying Harriers in the first place. You know, we're not a fly-by-wire airplane. You have full control over your airplane, both, you know, the primary control surfaces, the, you know, horizontal stab, the ailerons, and the rudder. And you also have full control over your nozzles. There's no computer telling you, you know, hey, that's a bad idea. So it's all you. One of the advantages we do have in the Aviate B over the Aviate A is the stability augmentation system, which kind of helps us out a little bit in the hover, but no, there are still a lot of ways where you as the pilot can make things go very, very wrong when you're flying the Harrier. So to give a long answer to a short question, yeah, the Harrier is a very difficult airplane to fly, but it's also very rewarding. You certainly get a good sense of accomplishment every time you fly it.
That surprises me. I thought it was all autopilot. You know, you flipped a switch and it stabilizes and you say over there and then it goes over there. No.
Yeah. And it's 100% you in the hover, which coming into the boat at night, low light certainly makes things interesting.
There you go. All right. That's why they made a movie about you. So you guys, know your men in case you're questioning that, but, that stuff at night will certainly affirm that. All right, let's talk about ISIL. First of all, when you begin to outline and talk about this, the overarching premise behind your article is what?
So the overall premise behind the article, again, it's making sure that when we fight a war, we use the right strategy because we're going to need to tailor our strategy to the fight in which we're engaged. And if we you know, if we go in thinking this is an insurgency and we do a full-blown counterinsurgent strategy, then we have some missed opportunities, certainly as far as air power goes. But if we properly define the fight, if we recognize that ISIS is acting like a state actor, acting more like a conventional military with very well established forward line of troops, then we would execute a different strategy, obviously, than if we were treating it as a counterinsurgency fight. So the overarching point is making sure, you know, we correctly define ISIL as an organization, and by correctly defining it, we can apply the appropriate strategy to defeating them.
Okay, so let's talk about that. What's the appropriate term that we apply to ISIL? Is it an insurgency? Is it terrorism? What is it?
So I'd probably say, and again, there's more nuance than just calling it a conventional enemy, than just calling it a terrorist group. I think probably the best characterization would be as a conventional force that employs terrorist tactics from time to time to achieve its objectives. Because again, you can't argue that ISIL does not employ terrorist tactics, because we've seen it, you know, San Bernardino, we saw it in Paris. We even see it a little bit on the battlefield there. Things like their public executions are kind of psyops, right, to intimidate their enemies. And I also think there is an element of insurgency in them, especially, you know, as they start to get defeated on the battlefield. I think they're starting to recognize, hey, you know, we kind of need these people to help us out, you know, in Mosul, which, you know, certainly there have been airstrikes going on in Mosul for most of the war, but as the fight nears Mosul, they realize, hey, you know, the fight isn't in Ramadi anymore. It's up here in Mosul. This is our last stand in Iraq. We kind of need these people to hide amongst. And that's just my observation from outside. Right. I'm obviously not over there, not over there at the current time. So I think there's another reason why we're going to see counterinsurgency strategies as well prop up, and I mentioned this in the article, is that this isn't World War II, where we're trying to bolster the French against Nazi Germany, where we're aiding an established government that has, you know, a history there. We're trying to bolster a fledgling Iraqi government that has, you know, some decent problems with its armed forces. There is going to be a flavor of counterinsurgency. You're still going to see those, you know, embedded training teams trying to teach the Iraqi army tactics. So there is going to be that flavor of counterinsurgency. But again, I think the best characterization is as a conventional force. They've even, and I mentioned that in the article to you, they've even used what could aptly be described as maneuver warfare, you know, classic Marine Corps force-on-force doctrine, in how they took the city of Deir ez-Zor in eastern Syria.
Well, I would tell you that throughout, in my two deployments to Iraq in 2004 and 2006, they were good at maneuver warfare. One, they watched everything you did. Two, there was always a distraction before they hit you. They tried to blindside you, and they had to do that to get close to you. The thing they weren't good at was sight alignment, sight picture. Had they been good at sight alignment, sight picture, honestly, our casualties would have been five times what they were, you know, easily, because they decided the time and place of engagement. We rarely did. And so we were somewhat of a counterpuncher as they dictated the fight, when and where they would come out of the populace and fight us. And so if they could have been better shooters, I think that conflict would have gotten much more serious, much quicker, simply because our casualties would have been so high. And so I agree with you. They can think it, no doubt about it. Because, and I'll just give you an example. You're in a firm base someplace, and they're watching you. They shoot mortars. Your OP comes down. Okay, now they poked your eyes out. So now they have a route for their suicide vehicle that's going to try to penetrate your gate. So then they shoot mortars and machine guns at you to see what you do. Do you come out? Do you duck? Once they establish the fact that you duck, mortars, machine comes, come at you from one direction, and the vehicle's coming at you from another. So they pound you with the mortars, they shoot the machine guns, you're trying to get your bearing. If you don't have security in 360, you're going to have a vehicle full of 152 rounds explode very close to you, if not inside your perimeter, depending on what you do when you pull your OP down. And they watch it, they think it, and so I agree with you. And the reason they've survived, a lot of them, is because they're smart. They're not stupid. And they're willing to kill you, and they're willing to take risks to do it. So I absolutely agree with you. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I think one of the important points that you brought up there too, is you mentioned they decide when and where to come out of the populace, and I think that's one of the major things that distinguishes the current fight in Iraq from the counterinsurgency that we fought in the 2000s. Is that, and again, I don't want to be overly generalistic, say this is the case all the time, but by and large, a lot of those populations, you look at Fallujah, the people of Fallujah were under ISIS, the people of Fallujah were starving, they were trying to flee. These aren't people who are willingly trying to help out the terrorist organization. So ISIS does not have that advantage everywhere of being able to just,
right,
you know, melt into the population, come out where they want to attack you, then melt right back in.
My guest today is Matt Foreman, Captain, United States Marine Corps. Talk to me about if Daesh isn't an insurgency, what's the appropriate? Because it seems like they morph in that spectrum a little bit. How would you categorize Daesh?
And again, I think they're by and large a conventional force.
Okay.
You know, their goal is to, so another way to put it, the insurgents' battle for the most part is for the mind of the local populace. They are trying to turn the minds of the city. So, it was a common thing in counterinsurgency studies is a spectrum. You know, on the extreme, on one end, is you have people who are fully committed to the government. You know, they want to support the counterinsurgent government. On the other end, you have the people who are fully committed to the insurgency. They fully want to, you know, bolster the insurgency. That, you know, those two extremes aren't necessarily highly populated. That's not necessarily a large part of the populace. But there's some gray area in between that. You have the people who, while they may support the government, they're not necessarily out there fighting for the government. And you have the people who, while they might support the insurgents, they're not out there, you know, providing safe houses for them. And then you have the people squarely in the middle. And what the counterinsurgent force seeks to do is, you know, they're probably not going to win over the people who are on the extreme insurgent side. Oftentimes the best way to deal with them is killing them. But they're aiming for those people who are, you know, supporting, but they're not necessarily ardent supporters. They're trying to either, if not pull them over to the government side, pull them straight over to the middle. So, to answer your question as to what type of army they are, this isn't the battlefield we're fighting. We're not fighting that battle for the mind of the population. What we're fighting is a battle to take and hold ground. You know, to take the city of Sinjar, which we saw in late 2015, to take the city of Ramadi, to take the city of Fallujah, and now to try and take the city of Mosul and to take the city of Raqqa in Syria.
The interesting. Let me ask you a current events question. I still see in the news, we call it Raqqa. You seem to be much more culturally savvy than we are. There's people are alluding to Raqqa, and I want to say I can't remember his last name, Lieutenant General somebody in Iraq. He said he expects the campaign against Raqqa and Mosul to conclude within the next 6 months. It's we haven't even discussed actions in Syria against Raqqa. I'm curious about your thoughts on that. How the hell does that happen? Do the Iraqis, I mean, I don't even know that the Iraqis want to go there. and invade Syria. Can they do that? Do they do that? Yet it was almost like an assumptive close when he threw that statement out there.
Yeah, so I don't think it's going to be the Iraqi forces fighting there. That again is one of the things that is going to give this war a flavor of counterinsurgency is, and we see it in the fight against ISIS in Iraq too, is that populations, even if they hate ISIS, you know, even if they hate the Assad government, then they're going to generally be wary of outside forces that they don't necessarily like coming in to help them. So I can't speak necessarily for what the national strategy is going to be, what the generals are going to do in Syria, but I would suspect that the war in Syria is going to continue being what it is today, and it's mostly going to be the SDF fighters, the Syrian Defense Force, the Kurds in Syria, and various other rebel groups that are going to advance.
Okay.
They're certainly capable fighters. I think there's a pretty healthy respect for what the Kurds were able to do. Obviously, when we talk about that, you get into much bigger, grand strategy. Because any time you provide support for the Kurds, you're also probably going to anger Turkey as well, who's also started participating in Syria. So there's going to be a delicate balance there.
The email question for you. Hey, Mac, interesting discussion about defining ISIL. My question, center of gravity. What is their center of gravity? Matt?
So I think I think their center of gravity is their ability to take and hold ground. Ultimately, again, I think I even mentioned that in the article as well. Try and find it. I have it up in front of me. But again, I think their center of gravity is their ability to take and hold ground. ISIS, you know, that was one of the big things that shocked the world about ISIS was how this band of fighters was able to, you know, overrun territory from, you know, Kobani in Syria in the west to all the way to Mosul, the second largest city in Iraq, and that they were able to do it so quickly.
Right.
So, again, this is, you know, getting into the EWS type stuff with this, the center of gravity, I think their ability to take and hold ground, they certainly do that unlike any force we've seen in Iraq before. You know, the previous forces that, you know, you were fighting against in probably 2004, probably Fallujah, Ramadi, Haditha, those types of areas, they weren't, you know, there, it wasn't necessarily, you could clear buildings and you could try and define the forward line of friendly troops. But, you know, again, it's an insurgency. You know, what's to say that house you just cleared, the guy didn't just do a really good job of hiding his weapons and then he's going to pop up and attack you from behind.
No, it's the way that it goes. Josh, another email. Hey, Mac, I'm curious, as they are defeated, and they certainly will be, in time, and I do think that we're doing the right thing relative to the Iraqis in front and us in support, because I don't believe, after all the Americans that have died over there, that we should get anywhere near the front of this thing. So if it takes longer, so be it. They can pay for it in terms of money and in terms of blood, and we should be okay with that. It'll go at their pace, but it will be their war, not ours. My question is this. Once defeated, do they become a terrorist organization again and morph back into possibly what we saw in Ramadi, Fallujah, in Al Anbar, certainly during the period of 2004 to say 2010, do they morph back?
Yes, there are several different facets to that question. Again, I mentioned it. I absolutely concur that the right idea is to have the Iraqis in the front because, you know, again, we saw it in the initial invasion of Iraq where we planned to invade. You know, overthrow Saddam Hussein, we didn't necessarily plan for the what comes next. We have to think about that with ISIS. What comes after we defeat them? Because if, you know, if it's an American army on the front, then we've seen it before. The population of Iraq does not like the American army sitting in its cities. So if we were to do that strategy, that, you know, maybe it would develop into an insurgency. I don't think that's necessarily going to happen with ISIS developing a new insurgency, especially because we're using those local forces to retake their own cities. You know, we're using the Kurds up north. We're using the CTF down in the south. So that covers the insurgent question. As far as the terrorist thing goes, I mentioned in the last paragraph of the article that I think that is an entirely different question. The terrorist attacks in Iraq, you know, maybe if the Iraqi army isn't strong enough, ISIS might be able to go back. But again, in order for ISIS to successfully do those sorts of things, they need to be able to blend into the population. Because if they're not blending into the population, it's a lot harder for, you know, a lot harder for them to conceal a safe house, to successfully hide a bomb maker, if the local population is against them.
All right, so I'm going to ask you a political question then, that came up yesterday. Political question is this. When they're defeated in Syria and in the northern part of Iraq, and they move back to a place that's more familiar with them, in theory, Al-Anbar. Does Al-Anbar embrace them? Does that start another round of a civil war? And ultimately, does that lead to the partition of Iraq into three federal republics? How about that for a question, huh? You won't hear that on CNN. What do you think?
I don't think ISIS will be able to do in Al-Anbar what you know, Zarqawi's forces did in 2004, even though they were their ideological ancestors. I've flown over there. I've sat over Ramadi, and without getting into too much specific, I have watched refugees fleeing this organization. People are civilians that can leave ISIS at the cyclic rate. I don't think ISIS, what they've already done to the Iraqi population, and forgive me for using such an extreme term, they've figuratively and literally, in a lot of cases, they've been raping the Iraqi people for the last several years. I don't think that ISIS just rebounds from that and the people of Al-Anbar suddenly turn around and embrace them.
Wow.
Again, okay. You know, you look at Fallujah, look at the humanitarian crisis that occurred there with how many people were being starved. I don't think ISIS recovers from that.
Interesting. Okay. All right. His name is Matt Foreman. He's a captain. He's a Harrier pilot. He comes from Newhall, California, by way of the Naval Academy. Hey, Matt, anything that you want to say about your article that I haven't been smart enough to ask you?
No, I certainly enjoyed the discussion we had. It brought out a lot of the points that I wanted to hit when I wrote the article in the first place. So, nothing else.
All right. Well, Matt, let me tell you, I hope you don't mind if we have this kind of in a round table in the future that I call you up and you come back on.
Absolutely.
Okay. Bye.
Yeah, I'm going to be leaving for deployment fairly soon, so communications will be a little bit difficult, at least until, you know, probably the fall time frame.
Okay.
But I'd certainly be interested.
All right, bud. Well, first of all, good luck with cooking on Valentine's Day, and and thanks for doing this. Appreciate it. And just so you know, I thought the article was outstanding. It made me stop and think. Okay, well, what exactly is it? And this thing. And I do recall my own surprise at, like, they own what? You know? I mean, their oil business, the number of vehicles they own, the way they move petroleum and sell it as a means of financing their operations, all the different things they do that needed real estate and almost acting like a conventional force to do all that. And so very interesting, made me think. So I appreciate your effort, and thanks for doing this morning.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
All right. All right, thanks, Matt.
All right, take care.
There you go. That is Matt Foreman here on All Marine Radio. We're going to take a quick break. Michael Musselman joins us next, the gunner. And we're going to talk about Mike Flynn. Yeah. Holy smokes. Out on his ear. Don't go away.
All I can say about MilitaryByOwner.com is, wow, I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.
I'm an individual member. I joined the Global South Foundation because I believe in what it can do, and I also wanted to stay tied to the community that I was part of.
The benefits for individual members of the Global South Foundation are two things. One is networking, keeping in touch with the community, developing new relationships at any stage of your career. And secondly, it helps people stay abreast and up to date on the latest issues that the South community should be aware of.
The Global South Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.
I'm good. But I have a story, and I don't know where to start.
I'm good, but I feel alone in a crowd.
I'm good, but the past keeps coming back.
When the service member or veteran in your life says,
I'm good.
Are you really listening?
I'm good, but I can't get out of bed.
I'm good, but I can't sleep.
I'm good, but I feel overwhelmed.
I'm good, but I don't feel safe.
I'm good, but I still have nightmares.
I'm good. But I don't need any help.
I'm good, but I don't feel anything anymore.
I'm good, but I can't live like this anymore.
I'm really not so good. But are you ready to listen?
Suicide prevention is everyone's responsibility. Listen to the veteran or service member in your life. If you are in crisis or know someone who is, call the Veterans Crisis Line and Military Crisis Line at 1-800-273-8255 and press 1 for free 24/7 confidential support.
More than 2 million Americans have served in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the Department of Veterans Affairs reports that approximately 11 to 20% of those warriors may have experienced symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. As we recognize PTSD Awareness Month, Real Warriors Campaign volunteer Meg Mitchum, a former Army combat medic who served in Iraq, encourages fellow warriors to reach out when they need help.
The hardest step was admitting that I needed help coping with PTSD. Once I did, my command and unit fully supported me, and I was able to get the care I needed. Getting support helped me succeed in the military and now in my civilian career.
If you or a loved one is coping with an invisible wound, resources are available and they work. For more information, visit the Real Warriors campaign at realwarriors.net or call 866-966-1020.
As we recognize the service of America's men and women in uniform, let's also honor the families who sacrifice so much every day. Military families endure frequent deployments and separations. They carry on while their loved ones are sent into harm's way and wait patiently for their safe return. If you really want to honor a veteran, look for ways to support their families and thank them for their sacrifices. Go to legion.org/honorveterans to find out how you can help.
This is Montel Williams. As a U.S. Navy and Marine Corps veteran, I know the sacrifice that our servicemen and women make for us every single day. If you're a veteran or a military member transitioning out of the service, help is available to you. The U.S. Department of Labor can help you get training, find a good job, or further your education. Contact the Veterans Employment and Training Service at 866-487-2365 or visit dol.gov/vets.